The Pentagon expects to have 40,000 iPhones and Android smartphones on its military networks within the next year. Right now, the Defense Information Systems Agency has only deployed about 4,000, so the Pentagon has to average about 3,000 new devices every month to hit that goal. Horace Blackman is Vice President of Health and Life Sciences at Lockheed Martin, former Regional Chief Information Officer at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and watching this deployment unfold. Horace, my colleague Jared Serbu is reporting about this at federalnewsradio.com. When you read that report and you look at what the Pentagon is trying to do, what are the big challenges that you see ahead for the agency as they try to bring these devices online?
Well, Francis, first, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure. And the first thing I will tell you, when we think about the Pentagon deploying 40,000 iPhones, Androids, et cetera, it feels like deja vu. I mean, I can recall specifically about 4 years ago when the VA was leading this charge with a whopping 400 iPhones and iPads at the time, and it was groundbreaking. Now we're talking about deployments in the range of 40,000. An old boss of mine, Roger Baker, once said he can envision a day when the VA would have 100,000 iPhones, iPads, et cetera, in a network. Now, in thinking about that, the first thing comes to mind is, how do you protect that many devices? How do you actually deploy that many devices in that amount of time? And, you know, you've got real-life challenges such as, you know, with 40,000 of these devices, there are 40,000 opportunities for someone to mistakenly leave them on a train. So it comes down to, it's less about the device and more about the data, the information that those devices are used to access. So when we think about how to deploy them, they're actually the real-world task of how do you get that information, how do you get those devices provisioned, how do you get them staged, how do you get them in the hands of the users, how do you support them, but most importantly, how do you protect them? I think if you think about the concept of data at rest needing to stay at rest, that comes into play. And what we think about is using the devices really as a means to access information as opposed to something that actually has that information stored on it. And as we think about this, this is a problem that doesn't just occur with iPhones, iPads, Androids, whatever you may have. It actually is the same issue we face with desktop PCs, laptops, et cetera. So the first principle we want to look at is, how do we keep the information? How do we store it? How do we use things such as virtualization? There's products like Citrix, VMware, what have you. And how do we leverage other commercial products to protect these things and be able to do the things that we need to do to make sure the information is protected and the actual device is not exactly the thing that we're most focused on.
You are one of the first people, your former colleague at VA, Jerry Davis, was another who talked about the importance of securing the data and not the device. And yet, the device centric mentality is still important, at least, because Jared reports Mark Orndorff, the mission assurance executive at DISA, talks about the partnerships that they have with Apple, Samsung, and BlackBerry for security device-wise. I note, too, that they still have a ways to go in the Android universe, because if they've only got a deal with Samsung and they need deals with the other vendors, they have a fair amount of work ahead of them because that market is splintered up fairly considerably, isn't it?
No question about it. But, you know, you have to think about these in terms of tiers, Francis. The first thing is the information and understanding what sort of damage could be caused by the wrong information getting into the wrong hands of the wrong people, right? And I think once you kind of begin to look at how to reverse that to make sure you protect the information, I think the way that Jared pointed out, you know, he's got another point to that thing, too. When you look at 40,000 devices, let's say these things cost $100 each to deploy, you're talking about $4 million. That's actually real dollars, right? So you have an asset management exercise at play there as well. How do you actually identify, how do you actually account for, and how do you actually protect the physical asset as well? So there's a dual threat there, if you will, of making sure that you're protecting the information, which is first and foremost something that you need to do, but there's a mechanism to ensure that you're protecting the asset as well. You know, their products, you know, whether AirWatch, et cetera. You know, the work we do, we've done a lot of work around this this notion of securing the assets and ensuring the resilience of the infrastructure. There's something that's critically important there as well.
Horace Blackman of Lockheed Martin, my colleague Jared Serbu reporting on deployment of Apple and Android smartphones inside the Department of Defense. Horace, I think the thing about this story that jumped out at me was this passage. DISA's customer base for mobile devices is made up predominantly of Army users. The Navy and Marine Corps, at least for unclassified phones, are mostly leveraging the Navy Department's own contracts. Kimberly Rice, DISA's mobility program manager, tells Jared they're going to go after the Air Force next. That makes sense. It strikes me, though, that maybe there's a missed opportunity here for shared services to do all of these together. Am I off target there? Is there a reason why it might make sense if you're the Navy and Marine Corps to stick with your own contracts rather than bundling together with the other branches?
It's the old adage of how do you eat an elephant, Francis? It's one bite at a time, all right? This is always a challenge, you know, working in a large department. The Department of Defense is, you know, massive. And I think when you think about implementing something like 40,000 devices, the question is, where do you begin? The task at hand is still getting one device in the hands of one user at a time. And so, you know, the notion is you don't have the resources to deploy an army of 100,000 folks to get this done overnight. So you have to decide which are the user base or the segments of the user base that you can migrate over when. It makes sense to look at the contracts that you have in place, whether it's the Navy, Marine Corps, et cetera, who has contracts expiring when, how you can leverage those contracts and the durations of those contracts to phase this in the most appropriate manner. The folks at DOD do a great job at it. When we were thinking about, in my old world, that the VA, when you're looking at doing big things, you got to really look at it from that perspective. So it doesn't at all surprise me that that's the tack they're taking with this. So that's a critical element, because you get that wrong, the cost of doing this really can kind of get away from you.
Now, you are certainly familiar with the data element of this and protecting a very sensitive data with all of the data that you handled inside VA, for example, PII for medical data and so on. What does this look like from a classified perspective? Does that add an extra wrinkle to this, or is it similar just with higher levels of security?
It's a whole different world. When you start getting into classified information, you got to look at the requirements for the actual devices. You have to look at the requirements for the networks that you're on. You got to look at what, you know, how the requirements you have to meet for the different levels of classification and classified information. You got to look at what information can be accessed on what terminal, on what network, et cetera. So you're adding a whole another level of security. It's not that dissimilar. You brought up the issue of what we did, the VA and sort of healthcare. As you think about it, some of the same challenges exist in healthcare, right? You think about when what you have traditionally, most of your interaction with physician was face to face. You're getting into the point now where your clinician is going to do his rounds instead of the old clipboard. He's got an iPad with him. So, what information's on that device? How is that information? You mentioned PII. There's PII, which is a personally identifiable information. There's also PHI, which is the personal health information, which requires a different level of handling. You got to deal with HIPAA and another set of regulations that govern that. That's not dissimilar from what you've got in the classified space.
Horace, I want to ask you about another item while I have you, because I know that some of the work that you're doing involves cybersecurity on medical devices, and that's, again, experience that you took from VA. My colleague Jason Miller is writing about how DHS is looking at securing medical devices or what will be necessary to do so as the advent of the Internet of Everything or Internet of Things progresses. I have to confess, before I read Jason's story, that wasn't even something I thought of, but it makes sense when we think about Fitbits and all of these other things that are connected to the Internet. What are the questions that people should be asking about the Internet of Things inside federal agencies right now, do you think?
Well, the simple thing, I'll go back to the first answer I gave you when we think about devices. The important thing, if you think about the Internet of Everything, whether it's your toaster, your medical device, whether it's your refrigerator, whether it's a computer at your office, the thing that transcends all this is the information. And when we think about how to best ensure that we have the requisite level of cyber protection across the Internet of Everything, it comes down to how to protect the data and how to ensure we have what's called a full rights, the right people accessing the right information at the right time in the right way. All right. So we've got to look at, you know, increasingly the channels that are being used to transact this information. We've got to ensure those channels are hardened. We've got to make sure that the devices are as resilient as they can, and we minimize the degree to which data is actually stored on actual devices. And we've got to make sure the places at which the data remains at rest, or where the data is collected, whether it's to cloud or whether it's centralized repository, whatever the case may be, that we build in the requisite level of hardness, if you will, and resiliency in those things. And if you will, you institute things. There's a concept we've got called the cyber kill chain, where you have to understand the hierarchy of how all the information is stacked, if you will, and we can actually identify where there's vulnerabilities, if you will, and be able to go in and remediate things as a need arises.
Horace, why do you think it is so hard for us to get out of the device mentality and transition to this data mentality that you've mentioned several times in our conversation now?
I don't know that it is hard. I think it's happening. You know, you mentioned the Fitbit, right? The Fitbit's a device that collects information about everything from how many steps you take to how many hours you sleep. And that data is actually being, it's not about that Fitbit. It's actually about how the data is collected from that device and transacted in the cloud and is accessed through your iPhone. So right there, that notion of your Fitbit is an example of this new mentality, this new thinking. If you think about how you interacted with email 10 years ago, you had an email in your office, and you had the folks in IT would give you an email account, and you had servers there, et cetera. But increasingly, we have folks now, federal agencies, GSA, when Casey Coleman was there, who implemented the whole Google-based mail, where it's cloud-based email. We see more and more federal agencies going to cloud-based email. We're seeing more and more federal agencies embracing the cloud to do commodity storage, to transact mission-type data. We're looking at large repositories of information, everything from research to clinical data to intelligence-based data, whatever the case may be, being moved to the cloud, not just for ease of use and the ability to transact information, but really as a means to protect the information.
I guess the reason that I ask that question is because I think it applies in the Fitbit model and maybe in some of these other areas that we've discussed today, too. I still have a sense that people think primarily about the devices first and think secondarily about the information that they provide or are a conduit to.
Absolutely. But the thing is, you know, the what makes this successful, right? If you think about it, go back to the Fitbit example. What makes the Fitbit example is the people who wear a Fitbit, they don't have to understand that there's not data stored in that device. They may think that the Fitbit keeps all their stuff. I mean, it's a thing that, you know, it takes 20 minutes to charge the battery for a week. There certainly isn't a lot of capacity to store much in that thing, right?
Right.
But it's okay if people don't quite understand there's not a hard drive in your Fitbit. And that it's just syncing information to a centralized storage, some repository somewhere. But I think the focus is not to have people understand the process, but have people understand the functionality and the usability of the technology that's being delivered. I think that's where you see companies like Apple, like Google, really focus on what you can do with information as opposed to how the information really works. I mean, you see things like, you know, there's Chromebooks now. People aren't, you know, you don't quite get that there's not a lot of storage going on there. But that's another example of what you're seeing emerging.